You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Thank you all very much for coming. I'm Alan Beattie. I'm the International Economy Editor of the Financial Times here in D.C., so I have almost nothing to write about at the moment, as you can imagine. And we're here to discuss, with very good timing, central banking and how central banking might change. Now, back in the days when I used to be a central banker at the Bank of England...
Quinn, the mic is not on.
Hello.
And that?
No. Hello?
Still no?
No. Yeah.
That should be there?
Is it okay now?
That seems okay. So back when I used to be a central banker at the Bank of England, back in the late 1990s, central banking was actually dead easy. You had one instrument, which was the short-term interest rate. You had one target, which was the inflation target. And anyone who suggested otherwise would be shot dead in the corridors at the behest of the governor. Meanwhile, banking supervision was hived off to a separate agency, as it had been in most countries a long time before. I'm just going to project and then hope the microphone catches up with me at some point. Was hived off to a separate agency, Financial Services Authority, as it had been in most countries a long time before. And just to underline the fact that this was an entirely separate operation, which was not going to be allowed to infect the setting of monetary policy, it was moved several miles across town. I think it's safe to say that that model has now comprehensively broken down. Central banks largely failed to stop large credit bubbles blowing up during the 2000s, and they've now embarked on a range of measures that would once have been thought absolutely impossible, bringing interest rates to zero, setting quantitative easing targets, and of course, as we saw from the Swiss National Bank last week, setting currency targets and agreeing to intervene in unlimited measures until they hit them. There are, of course, the added and related issue of how one central bank's policy will spill over into other countries around the world. So to discuss this, we have a range of eminent people who are not just experts in the issues themselves, but also have experience in actually running policy. From your left, Andrés Velasco, who is the finance minister of Chile between...
Was.
Between 2006...
How relaxed I look now.
who, among other things, created an innovative fund to save Chile's copper windfall. He is now, as you can see, looking very relaxed in academia as a professor at Columbia University. Next to him is Raghu Rajan, again, another relaxed, formal-looking policymaker who was at the International Monetary Fund. I think it's safe to say when it had a less exciting time than it does now and is now back teaching finance at Chicago. Sri Molyani Indrawati, who, if she's looking concerned, that's because she's still currently, at this moment, a policymaker at the World Bank. And before that, she was Indonesia's Minister of Finance, an enormously well-regarded, I have heard it said, even treated as a rock star within the region. And immediately here is Eshwar Prasad, formerly head of the International Monetary Fund's China Division and now teaching trade and economics at Cornell University. Now, the format for this discussion is we're going to hear from each of the panelists one by one. I will ask a few questions, just to be provocative, and then we will open it up to questions from the audience. So to kick off, I think we're going to have Raghu.
Thanks very much. Let me tell you a little bit about how this group got together. First, I would like to thank the Sloan Foundation for agreeing to fund us and the Brookings Institution for hosting it. It started with a conversation amongst a group of us, primarily Barry Eichengreen and some of us, on whether we had anything to say as academics, former policymakers, and so on the way the world was moving. And you know, one of the things we thought we could contribute to was to provide new ideas, but with policy relevance, that were not so far outfield, out on left field, that that nobody would take it seriously. And we thought we'd form a group. We went and asked a bunch of eminent people that we thought we would like in the group, and everybody said yes. without exception. And then we started on the hard task of getting funding, but we found that the Sloan Foundation was very eager to help. Daniel Goroff was very instrumental in that happening. And then we needed a home, and Ishwar said, why not Brookings? And that's where we got the home. After that, we had to start the hard task of actually doing something. And that's where we realized that, you know, one of the difficulties in the eminent group that we had together was that we had a whole lot of generals and no foot soldiers. So the question came, who's going to do the work? And, you know, fortunately, everybody pitched in. Next question was, how do we reconcile different interests? I mean, there are people on all part, from all parts of the economic spectrum, many parts of the economic spectrum, I should say, represented on the committee. And as Andres kept saying during this process, a camel is a horse designed by a committee, and we're in the process of essentially doing that. But I think at the end of it, we've got a report together which does attempt to, A, say something which hopefully adds to the dialogue, and, B, that it's not so far out there that it will have absolutely no influence. What we're trying to do really is raise some questions about the existing framework of monetary policy, and propose what we think are legitimate concerns about it and ways that we might actually attempt a change. Clearly, we're hopeful that some of the proposals we make will catch over time, and while they may be a couple of them may be a little too optimistic at this point, it will actually have some effect. So with that preamble, let me quickly walk into the meat of the report. Essentially, we start with a consensus that Alan, to some extent, laid out. There's really the consensus emphasized, one, that there's really no trade-off between inflation and unemployment, that a long-run trade-off, I should say, or permanent trade-off, that central banks are fine focusing on inflation, and in that process, they do the best job they can on bringing down unemployment. That high and volatile inflation does depress growth, so you want to target inflation, and that inflation disproportionately harms poorer sections of society. And again, that's another reason why it should be kept low. So this was sort of the consensus behind the focus on inflation targeting, and in addition to the argument that inflation was good for a country in its own right, low inflation was good, there's also the sense that when a country focused on keeping inflation low, keeping its own house in order and allowing the exchange rate to adjust automatically, in a sense, allowed it to do the best contribution for the world. So you didn't have to have a separate eye on what was happening to the rest of the world as a result of your own policies. Everybody keeping their own house in order automatically resulted in a somewhat reasonable situation for the world. I would argue that a lot of the concern about this form of inflation targeting has emerged because some of these things have been called into question. One, for example, when you focus only on inflation, are you taking your eye off the ball on other aspects of the economy which would come back to hurt you? In this case, financial stability. Sometimes focusing only on inflation takes your eye off the financial stability ball, and it may be useful to keep an eye on what's going on in terms of credit and asset prices also, because it could come back to hurt you. Second, sometimes focusing on what's happening only in your economy and doing the best thing by that economy could still have ramifications elsewhere in the world and not necessarily to the benefit of those economies. And there are various ways spillovers could take place. One, of course, is through the effect of capital flows, which has become quite important, which have become quite important nowadays. But there could be other channels through which these spillovers take place. And increasingly, there are concerns that some forms of monetary intervention that are undertaken when normal channels of transmission in your economy aren't working could have heightened spillover effects. And by this, I'm talking about actions like purchasing bonds, QE2. One of the reasons for undertaking it is because the normal credit channels of transmission are not working in your economy. But that also implies that any actions in expanding domestic liquidity will tend to spill over to a greater extent outside because your domestic channels of transmitting liquidity aren't working that well. So all those are reasons to rethink the whole issue of what should central banking try and achieve, what kinds of objectives, what kinds of instruments. Let me spend 2 minutes on financial stability and then hand it over to Andres. We are arguing in the report for making financial stability an explicit part of central bank mandates. Now, people say, well, another mandate, it's already implicit. Aren't they already paying attention to it? I think there's some value to making it explicit, but it's not just putting it out there as an objective. It's also we are arguing that monetary policy is a legitimate instrument to try and achieve financial stability. There are occasions when your strongest tool, or your, maybe sometimes your only effective tool, is the interest rate. And to use that to try and achieve financial stability should not be ruled out. So you may sometimes undershoot your inflation target if, in the process of doing that, you create more sustainable growth by, in a sense, quelling the process by which credit flows into asset prices. Now, people have argued against this view by, let me just, in a sense, caricature the argument. The argument is you're basically saying we should tackle asset prices, we should try and prick them, we should try and prick bubbles, but it's very hard to identify bubbles. And given that we can't identify bubbles, we should probably not embark on this process of trying to lean against asset prices. And what we've tried to say in this report is that's not the right way of framing the question. The real question is whether asset prices are rising rapidly along with rapid credit expansion. That often proves to be a source of concern. And in that kind of environment, the question you should be asking yourself as a regulator is, what if current easy financing conditions attenuate or reverse? Will we then get serious adverse effects on growth? And if the answer is yes, that creates an environment where you should be more open to leaning against credit expansion, against asset price growth. In other words, you're not asking, are these asset prices fundamentally justified? Instead, you're asking, is the credit expansion process sustainable? And if it does reverse, what are the consequences? I think this kind of question is important to ask because otherwise monetary policy is allowing a very dangerous asymmetry. The asymmetry is when the asset price is booming, when credit is booming, you do nothing because you don't want to stand against these, you can't recognize bubbles. But of course, when the bubble is pricked and collapses, you pull out all stops because, of course, growth is impacted. So it does create a put option, in a sense, for those who are boosting asset prices, creates a dangerous problem for the world. In the report, we also emphasize the use of macroprudential tools. One important aspect we emphasize is the need to try and lodge responsibility for financial stability in the central bank. Again, this perhaps is adding to the central bank's burdens, but given that it is the entity that has the strongest tool at its command, which is monetary policy, it is important that financial stability burdens be lodged there. And finally, when we talk about capital controls, we argue that the wrong question, again, from the perspective of capital controls, is to ask whether these capital controls prevented the exchange rate from rising, That's often the metric by which capital controls are viewed as effective or not effective. We think the bigger role of capital controls in the rare occasion when they have to be used is more to ensure financial stability. That if capital is pouring in and fueling a rapid expansion in credit and also asset liability mismatches, as well as currency mismatches, to try and put some sand in the wheels of capital flows so as to extend maturities, change the currency composition, that's important for financial stability in its own right, and that's the way we should see the use of capital controls rather than whether it keeps down the exchange rate or not. That's basically our first chapter on financial stability and why it should be made an explicit part of the monetary of the central bank's mandate.
Thank you very much. And now I think we hear from others.
Thank you. Before I get into the substance of the two chapters I am going to discuss for you, let me tell you first how much fun it was to participate in this project and how terribly risky it was in that what do academics and finance ministers know about monetary policy, which of course is the province of central bankers. So we're all aware that we're stepping into a terrain which is fraught with many complexities, but we do hope that, at least I learned, we learned, we do hope that you will learn as well.
We have one former central banker. We have
one former central banker, of course. Arminio Fraga from Brazil, yes, who reminded us along the way a few times that he wished there were more there. In any case, I want to discuss chapter 3 and 4 of the report. Chapter 3 has to do with spillovers. In order to criticize a framework, you have to describe it, and of course, describing it simply will make the criticism easier later on. So let me tell you how we characterize the state of play, the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is sometimes summarized by saying that over the last 10 or 20 years, countries were advised to follow an inflation-targeting plus floating regime. You use monetary policy to target inflation. You worry about the things that matter for inflation, like the output gap, and you let the exchange rate do whatever the exchange rate is going to do in a freely floating market. In that way of looking at the world, which of course is a great deal more complex than this, but I don't think this description is entirely unfair, in that world, the exchange rate is not a target for monetary policy. There's no feedback rule from the exchange rate to, say, interest rates. And secondly, the policymaker does not have to worry about issues of international adjustment, the current account, the trade balance, and certainly not about things that fall outside the country, because presumably the exchange rate is moving around to take care of those things. So if the current account deficit is too large, or if the trade balance is in a large deficit, well, the exchange rate will move around and fix that. And the only circumstance in which the policymaker should worry about the external sector variables or the exchange rate is insofar as they may affect either inflation directly or indirectly via the output gap. So that's even for a small open economy, the prescription is focus on domestic variables. The foreign variables, to a large extent, will take care of themselves. In this framework, the possibility of international spillovers, of course, is recognized. You go back to the 1980s, there's a very large literature on issues of international policy coordination, etc., etc. However, we think it is fair to say that they do not take center stage. They're really marginal as opposed to central in the way you conceive of the world and in the way you carry out monetary policy. The other part of this conventional wisdom, although this is seldom made very explicit, is really a hope, is that countries gradually would adopt this worldwide. This began, of course, in Europe. It quickly moved across the English-speaking world to places like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and moved very quickly to most, not all, Latin American countries, and to some of the smaller emerging Asian economies. However, it did not become as widely spread around the world, as some, certainly the IT advocates, had hoped. And we have a graph in the paper showing that, in fact, the share of world GDP and the share of world exports covered by countries which are not under this regime is, in fact, growing over time. And part of it, of course, has to do with the fact that China is a much larger country as a share of the world economy, and China does not have a floating exchange. Now, what are the implications of this? One implication is that in the absence of convergence toward floating worldwide, the exchange rate has not served as an effective tool for international adjustment. And one outgrowth of that is that we've had a number of years with very large and reasonably persistent current account imbalances, you know, the global imbalances that people talked about so much. Those were very large before the crisis. They came down, of course, as demand in the deficit countries like the US or the UK collapsed during the crisis, but they've come back up, and the IMF, well, we'll see what the IMF says next week, but in the recent IMF economic outlooks, there's a forecast of imbalances growing slowly again as you look into the future. So first deviation from the framework, we don't have convergence in IT plus floating regimes, and therefore the exchange rate does not play the role that it was supposed to play. This gives rise to all kinds of international issues, because it gives rise to collective action issues, and it also gives rise, you know, if you don't fix, or if you don't float, you do fix, you don't only affect your citizens, you're affecting other people. For instance, countries in Asia that compete with China and third markets for exports worry about whatever is going to happen to the real exchange rate of China. And of course, it has given to something that is less academic sounding, but which has made the headlines, the so-called currency wars, in the phrase coined by Brazil's Minister of Finance. The second deviation from the core framework has to do not with the existence of spillovers, but with the size of spillovers. We've known all along that spillovers could happen. We've known all along that financial flows typically dwarf trade flows. However, the size of potential spillovers seems to be growing over time. And we make three arguments in the report to try to underscore this case for a larger and perhaps more cumbersome and more dangerous role for spillovers. The first one is the sheer size of financial flows and the existence of a very large pool of very interest-sensitive funds out there ready to go to any country which has higher interest rates. Where does this footloose capital come from? Simply from the persistence of global imbalances. Countries that run current account surpluses accumulate assets. Those assets sit in central banks and sovereign wealth funds and elsewhere, and they're looking for yield. So one can make the case that today financial flows play a larger role than they did when this framework was crafted 15 or 20 years ago. Secondly, we argue that commodity prices also play a role in transmitting and furthering in these spillovers. Loose monetary policy in the major systemically important countries, among them the U.S., arguably has a role in beefing up commodity prices. And, of course, there's a big and heated debate on this, but a not-too-radical view would be to say that in a world of scarce assets, this is a view associated with Ricardo Caballero of MIT, this liquidity is looking for things in which to invest, assets into which to invest, and pieces of paper linked to the performance of commodity prices are one such asset. There's big demand for these assets. This arguably keeps commodity prices up. But of course, if you're a commodity producer and suddenly the price of your exports has gone up, then you're more creditworthy, capital is going to flow into your country, and the spillover issue is going to be magnified. So there's an interaction between commodity prices and financial flows. The third channel, which arguably has increased the role of spillovers, has to do with crisis times. We argue that in crisis times, spillovers are larger than in normal times. when countries are in financial crisis or close to it, and they engage in non-conventional monetary policies, there's a risk that a larger share of that additional liquidity will go overseas. Why? For a number of reasons. One is that credit demand is weak locally, and a second reason is that local banks are especially reluctant to lend at times of financial distress. And therefore, for every dollar you pump into the system, a larger share of that dollar may go out into the Brazils or Indonesias or Colombias of the world than would be the case under more normal circumstances. So we do think that spillovers are an issue. We do think that spillovers are larger than was once thought. And we do think that spillovers, therefore, provide a case for rethinking this framework and also for tackling head-on the collective action problems that arise from the existence of spillovers. And in the concluding sections, which I will not talk about, there are some suggestions on how to deal with that. That's chapter 3. Let me just say a couple of things about chapter 4. Chapter 4 simply aims to recognize that there are some new and important challenges to monetary policy, which, precisely because they are so new, again, may not have been fully taken into account when we thought about inflation targeting plus floating a decade or two ago. The first challenge is most present in rich countries, and it is the challenge of large public debt. Of course, having weak fiscal policy and large public debts has always been an issue for monetary policy. And, you know, being from Latin America, I am perfectly aware that the link between monetary and fiscal policy has a long and distinguished history. You know, we invented it. Oh, not quite, but we perfected it. And therefore, in some sense, this is not an issue. What is new is, again, the size of some of these debts and the fact that they're prevalent today not in emerging nations but in developed countries. And the report argues that perhaps some of those tricks that were developed so cleverly in places like Latin America may be finding their way toward developed countries. It is not so hard to envision, and some of it is happening already, how you might provide incentives for local banks to hold government bonds, or how you might provide incentives for pension funds over which the government has some say to hold government bonds. This, of course, was done in history, not only in Latin America, in the U.S. in the 1940s, for instance, during World War II. It has been used in many other quarters of the world. The question is, to what extent will it be coming back into fashion? And, of course, the other link between monetary and fiscal policy nowadays is most evident in Europe. When you have a large public debt, some of that public debt is short maturity and yields jump, there is a risk of financial instability and there's large pressure for central banks to intervene and buy pieces of paper issued by the governments. And in the case of Europe, we've seen many, how can I phrase this politely, turns, shifts of emphasis in what the ECB was willing and not willing to do. And today we find the ECB buying large quantities of Spanish paper, Italian paper, the kinds of things that the ECB had said would not be done just a few months ago. So we argue that this is a new and difficult issue with which central banking has to wrestle. The other issue with which central banking has to wrestle really lies in emerging markets, and I've mentioned it already, so I'll just kind of enunciate it. That has to do with real exchange rate appreciation. Within our group, there were voices, Danny Roderick's probably most eloquently, that argue that growth in emerging markets is very tightly linked to competitive exchange rates. Therefore, allowing the real exchange rate to go anywhere is not good policy. And therefore, this ought to be within the kinds of things that central banks worry about. That was not a view that commanded unanimity, but which did carry a fair bit of weight, I think, within the discussions. And again, to the extent that this is a political issue, there are political pressures brought to bear on central banks. And just as in the case of public debt, one has to ask the question, well, are there threats to central bank independence coming from the issue of Dutch disease, in deindustrialization, real exchange rate appreciation? These are two very difficult issues. We don't claim to have a recipe for solving them, but we do say three things. I will mention them briefly and I will stop. The first thing we say is that central banks would be well advised to admit that these are issues. As the report phrases it, and I didn't write this paragraph, but I think it's a very good paragraph, central banks should not play the game of who, me, in this regard. These are real issues, and to the extent that central banks are perceived to be skirting the issues, to the extent that central banks are perceived to be part of the problem and not part of the solution, the political pressures brought to bear on central banks may become even larger, and therefore the threats to the independence of the central banks may become even larger. The second thing we say is that central banks should be crystal clear that they can play a role in tackling these issues, but they cannot play that role alone. Surely, if the problem is too much public debt, fiscal policy is the first lever. If the problem is financial instability, regulation is the first lever. If the problem is real exchange or appreciation, well, a tighter fiscal policy is also important. So monetary policy can play a role, but only alongside regulation, fiscal policy, and a number of other policies. And the third thing we say is that if central banks are going to veer into this mined and tricky terrain, they should be even more careful than usual in communicating. Monetizing public debt and providing liquidity assistance to governments can be observationally equivalent. And one does not know which one a central bank is doing unless the central bank tells us what the central bank is doing. Even then we may not know, but at least the central bank should try. So the third message is communications are even more important in this terrain. These are two additional challenges to monetary policy, which, in our view, provide yet one more argument for broadening this IT framework, which has served the world well, but which needs some rethinking at this point. Let me leave it there.
Thank you very much, Ishwar.
So my task is to selectively summarize a few of the conclusions we arrived at after the analysis that Raghu and Andres laid out so clearly. But let me preface my remarks by making two observations. One is that with this committee of very distinguished people, all of whom had very strong views, as was mentioned, there were differences of view. So we had two possible strategies. One was the let 1,000 flowers, or maybe let 16 flowers bloom strategy, which would have made the report very diffuse, or basically try to find language that everybody could agree on, which may have made the report much less interesting. So what we've done in the report is basically lay bare the areas in which there were differences. But the process that Andres and Raghu talked about was actually very useful in terms of all of us getting together and sort of understanding these different perspectives. So it turns out that in the end, we actually didn't have that much dissension within the group on substance. And when it came to the conclusions, as you've seen, everybody has signed off on these conclusions. And the second issue is that through these recommendations, we hope to make it safer for people who want to walk the corridors of central banks without getting shot just because they think about multiple mandates or multiple targets. There are different aspects of the recommendations that we try to bring together. And as Raghu pointed out, it's not like we live in a world where central banks are purely targeting inflation, even those that do claim to be targeting inflation. They do look at a variety of indicators. They do have multiple objectives. But the sense we got from the discussions and talking to central bankers in the field is that there isn't a good framework to guide many of these issues. And that essentially is what the report aims to do. Not all of it is revolutionary, but it does try to bring it together in one place to put it all together in a framework that I think will help guide future discussions. So the first set of recommendations is really about how financial stability ties in with the narrower objectives of price stability or the sort of dual mandate that the U.S. Federal Reserve has. And as Raghu pointed out, our view is that it's a very artificial separation, especially given what we've learned from the crisis, that thinking about macroeconomic stability and financial stability separately doesn't work. But operationally, we still need something to hang on to. And the issue here, again, is not to think about identifying or pricking asset price bubbles, because in the best of circumstances, these are difficult to identify. But the issue, again, is try to put together more clearly frameworks in which credit expansion can be looked at along with asset price changes in order to deal with potential problems that could create not just financial but also macroeconomic instability. One big issue then is where exactly the mandate for financial regulation should lie. As Raghu pointed out, we feel that it should be an essential part of central banking, but the institutional mechanisms in many countries are set up such that there is a separation. And again, one thing the crisis taught us is that whether it's the Financial Services Authority in the UK or a different sort of model like in the US where the Fed regulates the banks as well as runs monetary policy, it's not obvious what the right answer is. But one thing that is absolutely clear is that monetary policy does have a very important role to play in financial stability, and regulatory policies do have a very important role to play in macroeconomic stability. So finding mechanisms to have these two sets of policies mesh together is really what we intend to drive at. So getting the right mix between prudential and monetary policies is really the focus, although we lay out in different scenarios how exactly this could be achieved. But with these multiple mandates, especially if the mandates rest with the central bank, as Andres noted, there is the concern that a proliferation of mandates basically makes the central bank more subject to political capture. And we think, in fact, that with broader mandates, independence of the central bank or operational independence becomes much more important. But central banks, again, don't operate in a vacuum, and central bank independence is not a desideratum per se. Central banks do operate in a political context, but what is crucial there is accountability. So once the central banks do have a broader set of mandates, the question is how one comes up with a mechanism whereby they do have the operational independence and yet are accountable to the political discourse. And again, this is where we think this report might have a useful role to play in terms of thinking about why a central bank focusing just on an inflation target may actually not be doing its broader job of maintaining macroeconomic and financial stability. The issue of better communications then becomes much more important, trying to think about how these multiple mandates hang together and how the use of these multiple instruments works. In times when you have asset bubbles and expansion of credit, there might be a case for tightening of monetary policy, even if it means a short-term deviation from a clearly specified inflation target. And it's in that context that we think that this multiple mandate approach may actually give the central bank a lot more leeway in terms of achieving these big objectives. The other crucial issue which Andres talked about is spillovers. We live in a world now where it's impossible for large central banks, central banks of large economies, not to have effects on other economies. But ultimately, each central bank is responsible for policies and outcomes within its own country. How do we reconcile this difference? The problem right now is that there isn't a forum or even a framework for asking certain types of questions. For instance, one can ask the question, is U.S. monetary policy or the setting of U.S. monetary policy good for the U.S. economy? Or one can ask a different question, is the setting of U.S. monetary policy creating complications for emerging markets, the sort of currency wars that were referred to earlier? But we don't have a good framework for asking, is U.S. monetary policy in a general equilibrium sense really good for the world at large? Because ultimately, if the U.S. does not do well, and it's a very large economy, that has significant ramifications on the rest of the world. But these questions tend to be taken apart rather than pieced together. So what sort of institutional mechanism could do this? And again, the concept is much more important here than the precise formulation of how we think it should be done. But one way we think it could be done is through setting up an international monetary policy committee. Perhaps the central bankers of the 10 or 12 largest economies in the world, the six large reserve currency countries, as well as maybe five or six other central banks. And perhaps this is one way that having this group basically think about the mutual consistency of their policies could be helpful. These central bankers do meet at the BIS in a much more formalistic setting and in a much larger group. But we think there might be value to having the key central bankers in the world basically try to explain to the world at large, including to their own political leaders, how there might be inconsistencies in their policy settings and how both domestic policies and policies of other countries could potentially be reconciled. And this is going to become important even if we move to this idealized world. And as Andres pointed out, we're nowhere close to this so to speak, idealized world where every country has a price stability objective for its central bank and has flexible exchange rates. But even if we do get to that idealized world, these questions are going to become very important. Because again, if you have one country that needs loose monetary policy, especially if it's a large country, that has significant effects on other countries that may have a need for a very different policy setting. So ultimately, I think, even if it's not really coordination, having a forum to bring out these tensions, I think is going to be important rather than just this degenerating into these currency wars. The second set of recommendations is much more tightly focused on financial regulation, and Raghu has laid out many of these issues altogether. And there, basically, we take the consensus view that many of these macroprudential measures that have been discussed in the literature, including specific measures like using loan-to-value ratios and debt service-to-income ratios with appropriate cyclical adjustments, might be useful. But one thing we do emphasize in the report is that all of these do sound very good. Contingent capital buffers do sound very good. Countercyclical capital requirements sound very good. But the effectiveness of these tools still remains to be tested. And this becomes especially difficult when thinking about coordinating these policies across countries. And this ultimately is going to be a crucial issue, thinking about how one coordinates these policies, because given the nature of financial integration across the world, thinking about these policies in isolation doesn't work very well. Here again, there is a tension. The tension is that trying to get to a standard that all countries can agree to might mean a very watered-down standard. And there is a lot of stickiness in the initial conditions, given the very powerful forces that are arrayed against certain types of reforms. So our recommendation is basically that countries should at least agree upon a broad framework, a set of policies that they all put into place. And then based on country-specific conditions, these can be adjusted up or down. So ultimately, we think this coordination is going to be a crucial issue. The third set of recommendations directly touches upon the issue of spillovers. And this is where, as you can garner from the earlier discussion, there was the most disagreement among people from different schools of thought, people who had been on the front lines in different segments. But the general view of the committee was that we do live in a world where taking instruments like capital controls completely off the table is a level of purity or intellectual or ideological purity that is simply not warranted by the practical difficulties of the world we live in. Nevertheless, a lot of people on the committee were very concerned that tools like capital controls could be effective if used in a prudential sense, if applied uniformly across domestic and foreign investors, as the IMF, for instance, has been arguing. But these are going to become much less effective over time. Capital accounts are becoming more open in de facto terms. Financial institutions are having much broader operations. So the sense that capital controls really provide an important line of defense, I think, is becoming increasingly untenable. So we think these might have a role at the margin in terms of smoothing out volatility, but they are really no substitutes for the more fundamental reforms that are needed. But also, the sort of forum that we think about, the International Monetary Policy Committee, may be a way of thinking about what the implications are for individual countries' policy settings, as well as their mutual consistency, if a number of countries start undertaking these policies at the same time. So again, this is where the sort of committee approach we've recommend earlier, we think might be very useful in sort of putting these tensions on the table in a more direct way, rather than it just degenerating into public conflicts. And as Andres pointed out, financial repression is, again, a major concern that we caution about because, as our team member Carmen Reinhardt has pointed out, a lot of what is going on in the form of regulatory policies does have an element of financial repression to it, and this is something that clearly needs to be guarded against. So ultimately, the recommendation, report does have a number of very specific recommendations, which I will not go into in much detail. But the question is whether, again, we have set out a lot of new things on the table. And what I would emphasize again is that rather than the particulars of each recommendation, the concepts that we are putting in place are, I think, far more important because we think these serve as a basis for discussion. And one might, in a cynical way, argue that this is just theory catching up to practice because central banking in practice is a lot more flexible and pragmatic. But again, there has been a guiding framework, which is that of inflation targeting or a single price stability motive, price stability objective with flexible exchange rates. And we think it's very important for theory to sort of provide much more coherent guidance to the sort of practical approaches that central bankers are taking these days.
Thank you very much. And now to respond to all of those comments,
okay. Well, thank you for inviting me. This is really an interesting, especially for me, it's coming from Indonesia, who actually tried to adopt in the past this the technocratic framework. I mean, there are a couple of things that I try to comment in this case. First, that the central bank focusing in one single objective or goal, price stability. I mean, many of the small open economies have been shifting their thinking, and this is they are the one who adopt this thinking that you should focus on the price stability, which is going to create more credibility about your monetary policy. And that is also the result of, if you call it, the ASEAN financial crisis, 97-98, which they think that they need to specialize the central bank into one single focus. So that is one thing which is then, if we can call it in the past 15 years or 12 years or two decades, the stability of the inflation, the low inflation environment is there. So there are many of developing countries, emerging countries adopting that framework, and they gain the credibility in terms of the stability and low inflation environment. Although maybe you should argue also this result or the achievement also because of the role of the China, which is providing with a very cheap and low price of many manufacturing goods all over the world. But that is one achievement, and we certainly support that having a clarity about goals and instrument, which is one-on-one relation, is going to create more a clear result, but at the same time also a certain credibility. But at the same time, many of this financial stability, which is actually, I mean, the problem of financial crisis is not purely because of the value of the aggregate level of credit expansion or the asset bubble, but also because of the value of the prudential regulation enforcement. And many of them is also related to governance problem. So now we try to over this concept of using the monetary policy in order to also achieve the financial stability. We'll raise the issue about whether this accountability, which mentioned earlier, is going to be easily detected, or in this case, asked for the central bank, especially because at the same time, the central bank have their own self-interest. Definitely, a central bank is not coming with all credibility and respect in the sense that they are seen as the most successful in managing the economy and contributing to the stability. There are quite a lot of reason also in questioning about the internal check and balances as well as governance within the central bank, that they are going to avoid what you call it conflict of interest of having too big authority within themselves. So this is one thing which is need to be also questioned in terms of adding up this function, which is most of the small medium small open economies trying to focus on the price stability. Now they are adopting, and in this case is accommodating the new function of price stability. I'm not saying that because, for example, like Australia has been very successful of having a two separation of function. This is not because that this is supposed to be in a one institution like central bank. They can be in a two different institution like central bank and financial supervisory agency. Sometimes it is problem of personality in which they can communicate well, or in this case, it can be the institutional arrangement. But I think I can understand the spirit or the objective of this paper or this proposition is that you need to have these two is always working together. Pragmatically, it's definitely there. I mean, you cannot separate, and you don't have the luxury to have one instrument, one objective anymore when you are dealing with the complex economic environment and the policy which is interact each other. So that is something which we, I personally can understand the proposal, but it will be very difficult to translate it within the institutional setting. And that is going to be my second comment. I mean, when you put it into the institutional setting, the central bank, I think we have to look at what is the value as well as the success of this kind of arrangement. And that will touch the issue of the institutional arrangement, governance, and effectivity of all this one within one central bank, if we talk about at the national level first. And that's why I think separation, because I will use the Indonesian experience. This is a real experience, and changing the institutional setting mandate is not easy. Politically, it will take long. We have financial crisis in 97-98 for Indonesia. At that time, then the conclusion, including within the IMF package, you have to have the central bank, which is focusing on a financial inflation targeting and focus on this monetary policy. And the regulatory and all this supervisory is going to be separated. Along the way, even until now, if you are at Indonesia, this function of supervisory and regulation is still within the central bank. Because even over 10 years, they can lobby. The central bank can still lobby the politician to say that you should not separate us. And even with that, I must testify that it is not always successful in actually relying them in really watching for us. Of course, excuse me for because I was not central bank. I was a finance minister who have to pay the bill for whatever the value of central bank doing. And that is the question regarding the institutional setting within one central bank. It's not about whether you trust them, they can use pragmatically and effectively in managing both financial stability and the macroeconomic stability, that is low inflation environment. But you are questioning regarding whether they have the right setting, that they can assume that huge responsibility and authority with a very minimum accountability or check and balances. That is especially true in many countries in which I think whether this is related to central bank or you are dealing with a very big financial institute, they have a huge potential ability to influence the political forces surrounding them that they will like serve in order to favor their position, rather than really that you are having a noble idea that they're really thinking about a very good, noble objective of the maintaining the economy of the country. So they are just the same bunch of people, that they have a lot of power, and that is the power, it is not goes unchecked, it's going to be corrupt in a way. So this is one thing which is going to be in a political reality. You have to look at it in terms of this dilemma about providing with this all this function and authority vis-a-vis the check and balances and accountability. That is my comment. The second one is actually in terms of putting this within the context of the effectiveness. I guess in this case, if we try to look at other countries which is quite successful, although they have a separate two institution, they are actually been driven by a good personality, the central bank governor, as well as the FSA, whatever. As well as there is an institutional tradition which will making sure that the flow of information between the macroeconomic stability and financial stability is going to always be shared. And then at the same time, there is an institutional mechanism in which they are going to respond in a more coordinated way in order for them to identify what is the vulnerability, asset price, or in this case, something which will threatening whether this is macroeconomy or financial stability. So it is really driven by this communication. My third comment is in terms of the proposal of setting up the international monetary policy. I think I question this kind of proposal given the setting which we are having. And I was actually involved in this G20 Leaders Forum in the middle of 2008 crisis. I mean, the question is, are you asking about more a forum, or this is a mechanism that will ensure that you are going to have the policy coordination? If it is only a forum, you have the IMFC, you have the IMF already in this case, or even in this case, adding up to that, you have G20, you have G7, G8, in which you are actually dealing with so many forum. It is not lack of forum. So I think in this case, the question is what make them fail to become the real effective forum or a body or institution that will make them able to have a standing as well as the ability politically to act and to make decision which they see will gain much bigger benefit for the global economy, stability, prosperity, and so on, vis-a-vis the cost which they have to face immediately. Because each of the policy choices definitely have an immediate cost. And that cost is usually the one which is unbearable. Unfortunately, I think in this case, my observation, this is not about the forum. This is about the mismatch between the fact that the global economy has become globalized. You talk about capital which is borderless. But at the same time, each of the regulator and policymaker is still governed by their own sovereign status. So we are actually facing with a very critical question globally now, that we are so maybe successful in globalizing so many things, but the ability of the sovereign mechanism to actually deal with these consequences is not there. So you are going to deal with so many mismatch of these two institutional setting. You talk about you try very hard for every country, for example, making this trade agreement. You try to liberalize it. You adopt the capital flow, free capital flow, and all those things. But it's always like lag behind with the consequence of all this globalized thing, whether you talk about goods, capital, or even now people. Information is definitely there. So I think this is more on this mismatch and the question whether this kind of forum is going to match with this real problem that we are facing at the global level. That's my comment.
Thank you so much. Just wonder, before I start asking questions and opening up for questions, if any of the panelists would like to respond to any of the points that the respondent has brought up.
Just quickly on this last point, I think the point is very well taken. What do we gain by one more committee? And
I'd like to second that, by the way, as a journalist who covers lots of committees.
Right. And having been through many of these committees, I think members on this panel are pretty aware of how futile many of these committees are. Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of things we wanted to emphasize. One, the existing committees talk about a lot of other things also. And typically, the discussion rarely gets focused onto monetary policy. And I think we're exactly on the point where you ended up, which is with a globalized world, there is a global monetary policy stance. Nobody has responsibility for that. Nobody's talking about how these things add up. And what we're hopeful, we have no illusion that at this point, asking the U.S. Federal Reserve to take into account what happens as a consequence of its policies more than, you know, at second or third pass, it's not going to happen. Similarly, you know, China, its exchange rate policy, they're not going to worry too much about what its external effects are, and that's the reality. But what we're hopeful is getting I would differ a little bit from Ishwar in saying the number has to be even smaller than 10. Whenever you get more than 5, they don't really have a discussion. But getting a small number, which then has to come out and say, this is what we see the global stance at first pass, is going to actually get them to come up with a common statement, recognizing where the differences are and where, in some sense, they see the challenges. It doesn't mean any one of them does anything about it, but at least they recognize explicitly the challenges. Right now, I think the view in many of these international committees is broadly each country is allowed to have its own monetary policy, and we don't worry about the spillover effects that much, other than every once in a while we complain about currency wars and so on. But having them come together and regularly put out a statement can then form the basis over time to recognize that, yeah, this is incompatible, and yes, we should be acknowledging this much more in our domestic policy stance. That's when you start getting more of a sense that maybe it might be legitimate to have a spillover question being asked within each country. And that's when monetary policy could adjust over time. Not going to happen tomorrow, not going to happen next year, maybe 10 years from now. When you're forced to do this and you recognize the incompatibilities, we might eventually get to a place where you can actually have some bite.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, before I ask, open just up, let me just ask one question, Marianne, which is, picking up a point that both Andres and Eshwar made, which is we talked about the paradigm of inflation targeting and interest rates and the floating exchange rate. Of course, you both pointed out large parts of the world didn't actually have that. And many people would blame that for a large part of the financial crisis, in the sense that the cheap money that was being shoved at the American consumer by China, for example, was one of the things that puffed up the credit bubble. It's obviously impossible to go back and rerun the world a different way, but had that paradigm been universal, certainly had it been adopted by China, how much of this do you think we'd be talking about now? How much of that problem would this have solved?
My instinct is to say that it takes two to tango. And if you've ever been in a finance ministry or in any kind of policy-making position, you've spent a fair bit of time answering the phone and trying to tell investment bankers that, no, you did not want that extra billion that they were offering. If emerging markets were able to turn the investment bankers away, one would like to think that emerged markets would have been able to do the same thing. So yes, when you have a lot of liquidity floating around, that is a problem. But it is not a coincidence that the liquidity found itself into some corners of the world, the American real estate market, or the Irish real estate market, or the British or Spanish real estate market, with all the consequences we know. But it didn't make its way into other corners of the world. You know, there are countries in which there was a bubble, and the bubble burst. And there was a country, you know, a bunch of countries where that did not happen. The countries where that did not happen, coincidentally, were mostly countries where it had happened a decade earlier. So I suppose there's a theory in economics that says everybody will have a financial crisis, have it soon, and therefore learn the lessons. In Latin America, we had our financial crisis in 1981, 82, 83, and we learned full well that bankers should be kept on a very short leash. That was heterodoxy back then, as conventional wisdom right now.
So can I take a crack at that as well? I think I'll divide your question into two parts. Number one, is a single-minded focus on price stability one of the determining factors of the crisis? Now, again, any central banker will tell you that even if they have an inflation target, a pure price stability objective, they do look at everything insofar as it affects inflation. So if asset prices are rising very fast, through the welfare effect, it affects consumption and therefore affects future inflation. But we feel that there is a pretty strong basis for making a stronger statement that before the effects of inflation can be felt, rising credit expansion and asset price increases can boom and bust, creating fairly significant and large boom-bust cycles in the economy. So we think the inflation targeting approach needs to be made even more flexible than it already may have. And the second issue comes to this question of what if everybody was doing, so to speak, the right thing, having if everybody had been doing the right thing, having a price stability mandate for their central banks and running inflation targeting regimes with flexible exchange rates. I think this is where a report aims to be forward-looking, because we are far from this ideal as well. But once we get there, we're going to have to confront these issues about spillovers even more forcefully. And we are trying to think ahead about what sort of mechanisms are going to be needed to deal with that issue. So I think we are very far from it. I mean, once upon a time, Raghu was my boss. If he had said not 10 central banks, 6 central banks, I would have had to say, yes, sir. But on this committee now, we're all academics, so we can disagree, I think. But again, the number of central banks is not the core issue here. But the key issue here, again, is whether we have some forum to focus on this issue. And Dr. Indravati has correctly pointed out that an additional committee and another trip for central bankers is far from the desired thing. But I think having a forum where the focus is specifically on the spillover effects of domestic monetary policies is something that is going to become increasingly necessary for the world.
Sure. Thank you so much. If I could now open it up. I see someone here. If you could wait for the roving mic.
I'm Charan Singh. I've been working in the Reserve Bank for a very long time. Right now at the Independent Evaluation Office of the IMF. Views that I'm expressing certainly are mine. First, an observation. I think it's a good report, very meaningful, good time. But I'm surprised to see hardly any central banker in this group of 16 here. I would have expected in a report at this point of time, when we are just coming out of or getting into another crisis or coming out of one, central bankers who would have had the experience of working through this and then contributing to this report would have been very, very interesting. Why I specifically mention this is because one of the key findings of your report, saying that financial stability should be a mandate, probably could be already included in some of the central banks, like the Reserve Bank in India. Now, a question. I was expecting from Velasco, of course, something to say on international reserves. And of course, when he spoke about the commodity exporters, there by itself, you get two set of countries. And therefore, I was expecting to hear something on international reserves. Thank you.
Anyone like to respond to that?
I guess precisely because we keep having crisis, central bankers are too busy running the world. They don't have time to be writing reports, I suppose. No, you're absolutely right. At the outset, I said that clearly for academics and finance ministers or former finance ministers to step onto this difficult terrain is a tricky business. But let me add that I think precisely because central bankers talk to central bankers a lot, it is not an entirely futile exercise to have non-central bankers try to catch the attention of central bankers. Whether we will catch their attention and they will smile or whether they will bark, I am not quite sure, but we are hoping we will catch their attention. International reserves. The issue is not explicit in the report, but it is certainly lurking in the background. Ishwar mentioned it in passing, and it is relevant in connection with the issue of exchange rate appreciation in emerging markets. If you believe the purest, simplest version of the IT plus floating approach, then there's no need to have reserves because you will never intervene. But in reality, most countries that float also have reserves, which tell you right away that the purest and simplest version of the framework is not being used practically anywhere. If you look at the last 10 years, practically every floater has intervened at some point. Certainly Switzerland has recently and caught our attention, but in Latin America, every floater intervened. In Asia, every floater has intervened. New Zealand, Australia. New Zealand it may be the only one that hasn't, but I'm not entirely sure. But the bulk of countries do. And therefore, you need reserves. How large a set of reserves you need is going to depend exactly on what you're going to do with them. My view, and this is not something that is in the report, is that your reserves are really there not only to allow you to intervene in the currency markets, they are there to allow you to serve as lender of last resort to the banking system. Now, once you begin discussing these issues, you're immediately, I think, into a discussion which takes you beyond the pure, simple regime. All of these things are not within the regime. In practice, they do happen. One contribution of the report is to say, look, we're doing things that we're not talking about. They're confusing. Markets don't quite know what central banks are doing. If we have a language, a forum, and an acknowledgement that these are reasonable things to worry about, then clarity and transparency may be well-served, and the effectiveness of policy may be well-served.
Thank you. Jacek Osiński, National Bank of... IMF. My question is, you are talking about the coordination framework for the central banks, but usually central banks tend to be a second mover. So first they look at the fiscal policy, at the plans, and then they set up the policy. If you look at this exchange rate regime thing, usually it's the governments really that decides about FX regimes, and the central banks only executes this. So maybe we shouldn't talk here about the coordination between central banks, but rather as coordination between the governments. Thank you.
Rosa Alonso with the World Bank, formerly with the IMF. I think that having multiple objectives for central banks is long overdue, and I think it's beginning to be very well recognized. But why stop at looking at financial stability, exchange rate misalignments, and monetary spillovers? What about unemployment? Isn't that a big concern across the world? Shouldn't that be reintroduced as an objective as well? And the question also is, since coordinating macro stability, actually there is an international organization in charge of that. It's the fund. It's the IMF. And it has not just central bankers, but also ministries of finance. Why? I don't know why you picked the Bank of International Settlements over the IMF for this, for your committee.
I shall ask the two former IMF staffers for that particular.
In fact, you seem to be picking questions from IMF people. I wonder if they have a halo over their heads and spot them easily.
That's the whole session.
Come on, guys, defend the IMF. Somebody's got to.
A couple of.
I won't be it.
A couple of. What we said in the report is that we would like this committee to be set up, primarily tasked with talking about the global monetary policy stance, including issues of liquidity, etc. Where it is located, who it presents a report to, how frequent that report is, all those we've left delightfully vague, which is why we can have a discussion here about how many members of that group. I think what we want to emphasize is, and this goes back to the earlier question, that it is important to recognize the incompatibilities and put that front and center out there. And then how we adjust to that, whether we alter domestic mandates over time, those are things that need to be addressed. But first, let's recognize the incompatibilities. Let's start one step at a time. And so whether it's the government that has to do it or somebody else, let's first say monetary policy is incompatible, whether it's because regimes are incompatible, because fiscal policies are incompatible. That's a side issue. Right now, because we club all the discussion together, we don't recognize the fact that this policy, which is so tightly integrated across the world, we effectively have one global monetary policy because of all this integration. We don't spend time. On the unemployment issue, I would guess we didn't spend as much time discussing that, primarily because many of us were convinced that as far as monetary policy could do something, keeping inflation relatively low and stable was probably the best it could contribute to keeping unemployment low. In specific circumstances, whether it could do more is something we will be debating for some time, but it's not what the committee focused on.
Can I add one word on the business of whether the IMF is doing the job already, so why have yet one more body do the job? I don't quite know, but I would invite you to engage in the following experiment. The world's central bankers and finance ministers will converge upon this lovely city in the next week. They will talk about everything under the sun, and they will talk about things that are very pressing, such as, will the European continent still be there in a few weeks? Maybe there will be a focused and thorough discussion as to whether the overall monetary stance of the world is right or wrong. Maybe. If I had to guess, my guess would be no. Right? Secondly, even if they did have that enlightened discussion, the question is, who would know about it? The report is very precise in saying, not only do we want a talk shop, we want a report. And reports have a wonderful way of focusing people's minds. If you've got to commit it to paper, then you have to talk about it, and you have to worry about what message you're sending. So reports are not simply wasted paper, they're disciplining devices. Today we have no, as far as I know, we have no single regular set of pieces of paper in which the Fed and the ECB and the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan and so on and so forth have to tell the world, we think the monetary stance is right or wrong. If we get them to even talk about that and issue this report, I think we've gained something. And we need not create a new bureaucracy. We need not create a massive jamboree. Five, six, eight central bankers in a room. Central bankers, by the way, I love finance ministers. I used to be one, but this is not for them. If you get them in a room, lock them up for a day or two, have them come up with a report, I think you will have something additional to what we have today.
Sure. Can I just add a personal note on the issue of unemployment? I mean, the Federal Reserve actually does have a dual mandate, which is full employment and price stability at the same time. Mm-hmm. And when I covered the Fed, I used to ask, would you consider adding other things? At which point, every Fed official I ever talked to would blanch and say, if you send the Federal Reserve Act up to Capitol Hill and open it up again, it could come back with anything in it. Cotton subsidies, anything.
Of course.
There's a huge institutional reluctance, which I think people have talked about, to start debates which may end up in a very different position than the one that, brilliant technocrats would take it. Colin.
Alan, thank you. Colin Bradford from Brookings and CG. It seems to me there are three subjects here, and you've done very well in covering two of them in the report. And my question is whether you need to reconvene on the third one. The three subjects are global price stability, or domestic and global price stability, financial stability from a macroeconomic point of view, and financial stability from a regulatory point of view. And it seems to me you've done a wonderful job, both in writing, as far as I've been able to tell, reading it here on the spot, mm-hmm. as you've been talking, and orally in covering the first two. My question is really, and I think it's vital question, actually, to driving both, as you pointed out, Sri Mulyani, the domestic institutional aspects of how these problems are addressed, but also the international one, is how do you integrate strengthening national and global financial oversight, supervision, and regulatory institutions into a framework that is enlarging itself in its view about the relationship between financial stability and price stability. So is it possible that you reconvene yourselves? Am I right, first of all? It's unfair to say that you didn't cover, in writing at least, the regulatory part of this, and the regulatory part is actually crucial to the whole. So therefore, leaving it out, probably, why not reconvene, do a second report, and connect the tissue, so to speak? Thank you.
Anyone like to volunteer to write a second report?
I think we are in the process of considering what might form the basis of a second report. And it is along the issues, not so much of domestic regulation per se, but the issues of international spillovers and considering issues of international regulation. This cross-border lending, cross-border spillover of capital flows, how that is lent, what kinds of supervisory arrangements there are for those kinds of things. That seems to me an area which is very much under-researched and under-discussed, and that could be potentially one of the areas we focus on. But I don't think you're wrong in saying we have under-emphasized that particular area.
Yeah, so just to clarify, this is not a one-time committee with a one-time report. The Committee on International Economic and Policy Reform will probably exist till the International Monetary Policy Committee comes into being, so it could be around for a long time. our objective, again, was not to range too far. We wanted to focus on one issue, and one of the reasons why this group of some central bankers and some finance ministry officials came to talking about monetary policy was because we felt this was one issue where something needed to be put on the table, because monetary policy has become crucial and there isn't a good framework guiding what central banks are trying to do in practice. So that ended up being the focus of our first report, but it's by no means the last one.
I think we have time. Can we just take one right at the back over there? Thank you.
Thank you. Garth Trinkle, Department of Commerce. This is following up a little bit on the previous question, and I wanted to know if the three academics on the panel had any comment on the early warning systems that are being developed by the Peterson Institute. They've been under consideration at the Peterson Institution and elsewhere for several years now, 3 or 4 years. Is this tying into regulation, macroprudential regulation of debt to public, of income, national income to public debt and national income to private debt. We have the dual mandates of inflation and employment. In this multidimensional mandate consideration, would this include growth of national income? Would this include growth of national debt and then divided down between public and private? Thank you.
Early warning systems, Ishwar? Anything you've ever worked on?
Quickly, I'm not aware of what the Peterson Institute is doing. I don't know if my fellow panelists are. I mean, the problem that I think we saw when I was at the IMF with early warning systems is partly, you know, how effective they were, how much in terms of type 1 and type 2 errors, and obviously they were very good at signaling past crises, not that good at signaling future ones. But the other issue is, let's say you had a system which you were fairly confident of, convincing the bodies that need to be convinced that in fact there is a highly probable crisis is really the big issue. I mean, we talk as if we had this early warning system and, you know, once it started signaling red danger, everybody would react and do what was necessary. We tend to ignore the very strong political economy in favor of allowing things to be the way they are and not intervening so long as you're not 100% sure that, in fact, the crisis is going to happen tomorrow. There's always a tendency to, you know, kick the ball down the road, to avoid taking action. And that, to my mind, is the bigger issue rather than whether we have enough, you know, signs out there that that action needs to be taken.
It was Adam Posen is the name I failed. Yeah.
I'm sure he's doing good work. I haven't looked at it, and that's my feeling.
Okay. We're nearly at an end, but so I'm going to take my prerogative to ask one last extremely unfair question, which I'm going to give each of the panelists 30 seconds to answer.
Can we provide an extremely unfair answer?
Which is, given what we know now, given all the tools that we now know available and are making available, what should the Federal Reserve have done differently during the 2000s credit boom?
Well, if you take this framework that we're suggesting seriously, this expanded framework, monetary policy generally and the interest rate in particular should have been not entirely targeted, but at least partially targeted toward preventing a movement in asset prices which could later be reversed. I'm saying that almost verbatim because we struggled to come up with a phrase that made everybody happy. We all know now that there was a bubble in certain asset prices. We all know that bubble was reversed. We all know that there were some indications ex ante that that was a bubble. You couldn't be sure, but probabilistically it seemed like a good call. And we're suggesting that, in fact, if you see that happening, monetary policy has a business in worrying about that.
Sure.
In fact, the report is quite dramatic at some point. It says, if that means deviating from the kind of output gap that you would, you know, be targeting otherwise, so be it. And I think that's right.
Sure. So higher Fed funds rate, basically.
I think that and prudential measures, there could have been tighter prudential measures. I will say that I remember report after report of the World Economic Outlook, we said, things look fine, but we must remember financial conditions are extremely accommodative, and there is a risk of what happens when they reverse. But we never proposed any action on that basis. I think we would say this time that maybe we should have.
Really?
I think combination of monetary restraint, expansion which is less, and prudential must be much forceful on prudential.
I'm waiting for someone to advocate capital controls. I've not yet heard it. This one, you
I don't think this group would. I certainly won't. I don't think that is the answer. But I think, again, the issue this puts on the table is also an issue that we've been grappling with, which is how to think about global liquidity, because there was a lot of liquidity in the U.S. And, in fact, when Raghu and I were at the fund at the time, we were trying to grapple with this concept of coming up with global liquidity. It's a very loosely defined and unclear term, but it was clear that there was a lot of money sloshing around, not just here, but because of other countries' policies around the world, and that clearly had some negative implications. So, again, we can see the report as a sort of, as an argument for coming up with a better framework to think about those issues.
Great. Okay, and with that we're done. I'm sure we'd all like to thank the panelists for their time today.